And we move to the second case this morning, United States versus Ramirez. Okay, Mr. Hillis.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Ramirez. He raises two claims. First of these claims is that the district court procedurally erred by not considering my client's aging out defense. Now, aging out is a recognized ground for a reduced sentence to vary downward. It should be taken into account in any event in a correct assessment of the relevant sentencing factors.
Who recognizes that, Mr. Hillis? Aging out. Who recognizes
it? Yeah. Who recognizes it?
Yes.
Seventh Circuit in Presley, Your Honor. And there's an abundance of statistics that have been cited in the Presley decision from the Bureau of Justice and Statistics. So the Presley decision is of fairly recent origin in the Seventh Circuit. I mean, not so new that we have cause to doubt it, but it's been within the last, I think, 10 years that this court has issued Presley. And an array of other courts have likewise recognized aging out. And furthermore, the statistics account for that as well. So when a person reaches the age of 40 and proceeds beyond that, they are in a period of declining criminality. So aging out is a well-established ground for a lower sentence. And the government points out that my client's lawyer did not advance aging out until the district court began to inquire about circumstances in my client's history. But once the issue was raised, even by the court, it must then be considered by the court in a proper imposition of sentence. And there's the procedural error in this case, because my client his lawyer specifically mentioned aging out at page 13 in the appendix. So the judge should have considered it under Cunningham and that line of cases. And as the government's brief is unable to indicate anywhere where the judge did address it, we believe that there is a pretty definite record here to show the procedural error that would warrant resentencing, vacating the instant sentence, and remanding for reimposition of sentence with consideration of the aging out argument per Cunningham, Chapman in those cases.
Is Mr. Hillis, level of examination that you're asking of the district court to consider aging out based upon this defendant's age, obviously, the activity that he engaged in, the frequency. When I hear aging out as a defense, I often disaggregate certain crimes from others. Say some crimes like a sexual offense may not be aged out of, but something that would be more violent would be aged out of. What level of specificity are you asking for the district court to apply on a remand?
I would believe, like Your Honor just explained, it's on a case-by-case basis. So there may be certain offenses that we are unable to say are as apt to an aging out, say a fraud offense, and we've got other cases that involve more violent activity that the statistics track even better to show that there is an aging out. So the type of offense does matter, and the particular circumstance of the individual need to be accounted for. The problem here, though, Judge, is that that wasn't done. There was nothing said about aging out. So I would say that how much has to be more than zero, and here it was zero. So that's where our leaping off point is.
So we need to check this again to include that. Is that it?
The judge needs to include that. Yes, Your Honor. Under Cunningham and Chapman and those cases, this is a recognized area for a lower sentence, so a ground of recognized legal merit has to be accounted for as part of the procedural calculus.
Did the judge here ask the question at the end of the sentencing hearing whether he had adequately addressed the arguments in mitigation?
I don't recall that, Judge. If he did, it hasn't been the focus of any response from the government such that we can allay any concerns and say this is harmless. So that's the short answer on that as far as I can recall.
Okay, and what do we make of the fact that the counsel in the same paragraph where he raised the aging out point says it's not a strong argument because he was incarcerated most of the time, most of his adult life? And in fact, if I recall correctly, I hope I'm not confusing cases here, but basically got in trouble very quickly after every release.
Good, Your Honor, and you're not confusing anything. Your recollection's excellent. But my client was simply fronting what there are by way of some problems with an aging out defense, argument. But nevertheless, it remains something the district court should account for, and the district court could have embraced those facts and said that is not convinced that there is an aging out here. But nevertheless, it had to occur. And I think that my client's counsel may have misperceived the aging out by explaining things the way they did. Statistically, even though there have been periods of incarceration that followed hard on the heels of release, age is the relevant benchmark for determining an aging out offense. I don't see anything in the statistics to say that the period of time in which there is recidivism suggests that the person is not subject to a valid aging out argument. It is a function of age. It should have been considered, and it wasn't. Does the court have further questions on this point? If not, I'd like to move briefly to the substantive unreasonableness, as if the day isn't hard enough already.
You know you're busy today, Mr. Hillis.
Oh, it's not that, Judge. It is substantive unreasonableness, as Your Honor had indicated in the prior argument, is a tough road to climb. And the court has allowed substantive unreasonableness challenges before, but only when made by the government. So it appears to us that it is a one-way ratchet. It's an upward escalator. But under the case law, that shouldn't be so. And so while other courts
Have we done that when the government appealed guideline sentences or only below guidelines?
Judge, I don't have a ready answer for that, so I don't want to give a bad answer for it. I just don't know where it tracks relative to the guidelines. But I can't say that in Repking, what this court's jurisprudence established was any overemphasis on a particular sentencing factor is a basis to challenge for substantive unreasonableness. So it was a below-guideline sentence in Repking, and here it's an above-guideline sentence. But the factor nevertheless works in the analysis the same way. And so when the judge was concerned about my client's flight, that had already been accounted for in the obstruction enhancement. Same for criminal history. It was part of the guideline calculation itself when criminal history is factored in as part of the guideline determination. So these are the factors the district court relied on. They've been amply accounted for, especially with the flight. And the flight we take issue with anyway, because there's nothing about a particular rate of speed that my client traveled at such that it was especially dangerous. There's nothing in the record to show that there were a lot of people around, that there were any people. It was the police who were giving chase, and that is a normal part of police activity. It can result in some dangerousness, but there's nothing that was especially dangerous in any of the facts that are of record here. And so when the district court emphasized those two things, we believe that's an overstatement, an overemphasis, and under Repking, analytically, this case falls within the parameters.
Trying to escape doesn't make any difference then, counsel, right?
Oh, no, Judge. So we already have the obstruction enhancement, so that's accounted for. It's then when it is accounted for again as a basis to give an uptick that's 26% above the high end of the guideline range that we have a substantively unreasonable sentence. By overemphasizing that particular factor,
it may make sense, though, doesn't it, really?
Well, it can if there is a sufficient level of explanation that shows that there's no overstatement, but that
counsel,
wasn't done.
The judge is not required to go into explanation in detail, as you're indicating.
Not an undue amount of discussion, Judge, but an appropriate level, and we don't think that that occurred here. So with that, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Nathaniel Whalen here on behalf of the United States of America. The court did not procedurally err at sentencing, and the court's sentence was not substantively unreasonable. The district court has an obligation to address all principal arguments in mitigation. There is nothing principal about Mr. Ramirez's argument down below that he was allegedly aging out of criminal activity. In fact, as Judge Hamilton notes, defense counsel said they did not have a strong argument for it. And defense counsel was conceding truthfully what he had to, which is defendants who are aging out of criminal activity are not sitting in jail for yet another crime. And Judge Hamilton, you are remembering correctly that this is a defendant who, more or less since 1998 until the time of sentencing, had been facing some sentence or another, some criminal activity or another. And the district court noted that. I think, Judge Kaney, I think you're right that defense counsel is basically advocating that there is now a checklist of things you have to consider. And so because this court said in Presley that you have to aging out a relevant argument, now every district court judge is going to have to consider that at sentencing, especially when it's not raised in a sentencing memo, even when it's not raised in the defendant's initial argument, even when the defendant concedes it's not a strong argument for his case. And there's no support for that in the case law anywhere. Judge Hamilton.
Maybe you're about to answer my question. Have I addressed things sufficiently point?
The district court did not ask that question, Your Honor.
Do you know whether Judge Lichty does that routinely, or was this an aberration?
You know, this was one of Judge Lichty's early sentencings, Your Honor. I've truthfully not seen another one of the sentencing transcripts since. I know we've suggested to our South Bend AUSAs that they should bring that up at sentencing in hope of avoiding this type of appeal going forward.
Maybe I'm not tracking precisely the question that Judge Hamilton is making reference to. I do see at Appendix 27, the court at the end saying, Mr. Vanderkooy, do you have any concerns or objections with the proposed sentence or the reasons for it?
Yeah, that's not quite specific enough. The specific point was something developed in the case law in the wake of the Cunningham line of cases, where I know there was an opinion by Judge Flom and another one by me following up, encouraging district judges to avoid the Cunningham kind of reversal and trying to reconstruct their thinking 12 to 18 months after the sentencing. By saying, have I addressed your principal arguments in mitigation? And then if the answer is no, then the judge can do it then, think about it. I don't know, Mr. Hillis, I'm sure you see more of this than any of us, but how that's working in practice.
Judge, we've been pretty successful with that in our district, I think, usually. You know, I think, frankly, if the court had asked this question in this case, defense counsel would say yes, because aging out was not one of his principal arguments in mitigation. I don't want to answer the question for him, Your Honor. Unless this court has any questions on the procedural reasonableness, I want to turn to the substantive reasonableness, or I guess procedural sensing. There is no rule in this court's case law that says what the court can and can't consider in terms of when they're going to get reversed for a substantively unreasonable sentence. It's an abuse of discretion standard, and the district court has wide discretion as to the sentences that it gives. This case, it wasn't above guideline sentence, but the district court justified that with sufficient rationale. It noted that Mr. Ramirez has a lengthy criminal history. And yes, some of his criminal history was accounted for, but as the district court noted, there were 8 criminal convictions that weren't accounted for. The guidelines also don't take into account the fact that some of the 2 crimes he did get points for, the guidelines treat the same, really regardless of the severity of the crimes. And the district court, I think, was rightfully disturbed that one of the crimes was basically a drive-by shooting into a house with people inside. The other crime was what the district court described, and I'm paraphrasing here, as a terrible aggravated battery where the defendant broke someone's jaw and then broke the jaw of his children's mother and then laughed at her as she's blacking out. The court's allowed to consider that in imposing its sentence, and the court rightfully gave it the weight that it was entitled to. In terms of the argument about the flight, the reckless endangerment enhancement applies in situations without cars. It applies in situations where there are not many people put at risk, where there's maybe even one person put at risk. What we have here is the defendant engaging in a high rate of speed at 7:30 in a busy commercial district in South Bend. And we know it's a busy commercial district because the PSR talks about the fact that he's driving through a Candlewood Suites. He ends at a 7-Eleven, and this is dinner time, Your Honors. The PSR talks about the fact that he's driving through streets and parking lots with other cars' presence. He's driving through red lights. That isn't especially... Well, Your Honor, the PSR has both, right? It does say red lights in paragraph 8, and then later on... I'm sorry, paragraph 4, and then it talks about 1 later on. But I don't think that matters. The point is, this is a commercial district, and if the defense thought there wasn't a high rate of speed, they should have objected down below. We had the case agent ready, willing, and able to testify about the facts of this event. They didn't. And so when the PSR says in paragraph 8 that this is a high-speed chase at a high rate of speed, it says in paragraph 11, defendants driving at a high rate of speed. If defense counsel really truly had a problem with that and thought the district court couldn't rely on that, they should have objected. They didn't. And so the court adopted these findings as its own because they were uncontested. So the argument as to the facts is waived. Your Honors, this was a substantively reasonable sentence, and the district court considered the 3553A factors. Unless this court has any particular questions on either of the issues, we would ask that you affirm the sentence. Thank you.
Doesn't appear so. Thank you, Mr. Whalen. Mr. Hills?
Yes, Your Honor. The defense is not asking for a checklist process. We're just asking for a Cunningham-compliant process where the district court addresses principal arguments in mitigation, and it didn't happen. And your court's jurisprudence is excellent to advise district courts on how to avoid appeals of this type. But if a district court doesn't batten down the hatches, then this is the consequence. And it is not an unfair consequence because clients...
Counsel, I would venture to say there's not a chance of avoiding appeals of sentences in this time and place.
Well, we would love to see appeal waivers go out the window altogether, Your Honor. But that's not a view that is engaged in by others, certainly those in robes. So we understand courts are busy places, but... when rights come to issue, courts are supposed to consider these things, and it should consider it in this case. And the judge just didn't address the matter once raised, didn't engage in the sort of questioning that Judge Hamilton mentioned. And I'll say lastly, as to the substantive reasonableness, the defense isn't required to bring in the government's witnesses to have a better record for the government to work with on the appeal. So we won't be asking the government's agents questions to scuttle our chances on an appeal, but we will allow the government, of course, to make the best record that it can.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.